Hi, Guns Unpacked listeners. We do our best to make sure that episodes are timely and accurate, but these days, the world, including the world of firearms, is changing at a chaotic and fast-paced speed. Our commitment to building a better gun debate is not subject to change, but specific events, policies, and trends may have shifted by the time you listen to this podcast episode. Thank you for tuning in to in-depth conversations about guns that transcend the typical gun divides.
This special episode of Guns Unpacked features a live recording of the keynote address at the Bridges Initiative's first annual symposium, delivered on January 31st, 2025. This event featured a presentation by Yasser Payne and his collaborators Brooklyn Hitchens and Daryl Chambers, followed by a conversation about their work moderated by Marva Goodson, assistant professor of criminology here at ASU. The recording starts with my opening remarks, in which I share my co-host Jennifer Carlson's introduction to our keynote speakers and their fascinating 2023 book, Murdertown USA, Homicide, Structural Violence, and Activism in Wilmington.
All right, everybody, welcome. So I hope everybody can get settled here as we're about to get started. So I am delighted that you are all here for the closing panel of our inaugural symposium under the theme Bridging Gun Divides, Building a Better Gun Debate. Starting with our kickoff last night, we've had a day of stimulating conversation and insight that reflects our mission to pivot the insights of social science and the humanities to support a better gun debate. While our symposium officially ends tonight, I hope you'll sign up for our newsletter and consider following our work, especially our Guns Unpacked podcast, of which we're recording a special episode tonight with this amazing panel. We're grateful to Arizona State for supporting our vision here at the center, as well as the many sponsors and collaborators we have within and beyond the university. Our symposium, including last night's opening keynote event and tonight's closing keynote event, are supported through collaborations with the Builders Movement, as well as the Scholar Strategy Network, in addition to support from ASU's Barrett Honors College, the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice, the School of Public Affairs, the Humanities Lab, the Center for Child and Family Success, and the Academy for Justice. Of course, you know, foremost in our thoughts is our Center Director, Jenny Carlson, whose remarks on tonight's keynote I will now share. Because of our co-sponsors, collaborators, and logistics gurus, we're able to make good tonight on one of our key pillars, expanding the experts. What if we work to expand who counts as an expert in this arena in order to broaden the public impact of our research? What if we highlighted voices who transcend the terms of the gun debate? This panel tonight, under that, invites us not just to think sociologically about gun violence, but also to reconsider our capacity to expand the voices that need to animate this debate if we have any hope of transcending its current terms. I can think of no better interlocutors than the authors of Murdertown USA for thinking through these questions and modeling how to reckon with gun violence in ways that move us forward to sustainable, root cause focused intervention. Murdertown USA is the story of street life in Wilmington, Delaware, that examines how disinvestment alongside structural violence creates the conditions for gun violence and how communities respond accordingly. This book goes beyond standard criminological and even public health accounts of gun violence to recenter the important relationships and never loses sight of the fact that communities are so much more than the problems that are often used from the outside to define them. The book, however, isn't just an arm's length review of how gun violence unfolds in the communities most impacted by it. It's a remarkable demonstration of how the production of scholarship itself can be a part of the solution by engaging community members as collaborators, taking an innovative approach to the research process by re-envisioning it as vocational training, and yes, expanding the experts who get to weigh in on the question of gun violence in the US and solutions to it. Starting with our panelists today, Dr. Yasser Payne is in sociology and Africana studies, and a professor at the University of Delaware who specializes in resilience, structural violence, and gun violence among street-identified Black Americans. Using his street participatory action research framework, he merges research and activism to address systematic inequalities. He also leads local and national projects on gun violence, including Got the Hammer on Me, funded by Christiana Care Hospital and National Foundations, and is Wilmington-based The People's Report and Harlem documentary, The Streets of Harlem, explore the impacts of structural violence on marginalized communities. Dr. Brooklyn K. Hitchens is Associate Professor at the University of Maryland, College Park in the Department of Criminology and Criminal Justice. Dr. Hitchens' research examines urban Black women's and girls' experiences with street life and the criminal justice system, urban violence and trauma, hard-to-reach populations, and policing. Using street participatory action research, she works with low-income Black communities on examining and disrupting cycles of violence. Daryl Chambers is Executive Director of the Center for Structural Equity, a community-driven intervention and prevention program designed to empower youth and their communities to address issues of structural violence and to promote the social determinants of health. Mr. Chambers currently holds a master's degree in criminology from the University of Delaware and a Bachelor of Arts in Sociology from the University of California, Davis. And he serves as an assistant scientist at the University of Delaware's Center for Drug and Health Studies. Leading us in conversation with these three authors will be Dr. Marva Goodson, who is an assistant professor in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice here at Arizona State. Her research explores how social capital and the characteristics of personal social networks influence individuals' experience under community-based correctional supervision and their overall well-being. Dr. Goodson will be moderating the conversation after we hear an introduction to Murder Town from our authors, because we are recording for a podcast. When Dr. Goodson opens it up to Q&A, please line up behind the mic and ask your question into the mic, and we'll take the conversation from there. So please welcome our panelists and Dr. Goodson.
Good evening. Thank you, Dr. Young. Thank you also, Dr. Carlson. I know you're not here. Thank you all, Arizona State University, just for the invitation. Thank you for allowing us to share our work with you. And definitely our journey is centered in the center of our hearts and our bodies and our spirits. With that said, again, my name is Dr. Yasser Payne. I'm on faculty in the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice. And we're gonna take the next 30 minutes or so and just share with you an overview of Murder Town USA before we open it up to Q&A. They're gonna join me in this talk as well. All right, let's get started, y'all. 5 takeaways just really quickly, right? We think there's never enough time to talk about everything we want to, but if there's anything we want you to walk away with, right? We want you to know that Wilmington and or no city in the United States of America is a wild, wild west scenario. No city. If there was, they would send the National Guard in yesterday, right? So scholars and or local residents, we must take back the narrative on violence, right? In the neighborhoods and in the communities. And we do that with the communities. Number 2, small city size, right, has increased gun violence, right? Big size cities or violence in the big size cities in the 1990s, early 2000s, that is completely, right, inverted. Now, small and medium sized cities are now operating to some extent like the big size cities in terms of violence. Number 3, right, we cannot police, incarcerate, or gentrify our way out of the violence. Right? That cannot be the go-to intervention any longer. Number 4, poverty equals gun violence. And we make a case throughout the book on structural violence, but definitely by the last chapter or two, we really double or triple or quadruple down on an argument around Black reparations, particularly as it relates to poverty and more specifically gun violence. And number 5, we leave you with the message, more par, more street par. We strongly encourage you, right, to come join us on our journey, right, on organizing folk from the neighborhoods to do what we ultimately describe as God's work. All right, our title, Murder Town USA, is actually co-opted from Newsweek's article from 2014 called Murder Town. It's their language. We're just co-opting it. It was an article that also caught a lot of attention in Delaware. And to this day, Delaware is reeling, right, with its effect and impact. We write a lot about that in the book as well. Right. And we decided, we said, not to mention, right, Daryl Chambers, along with some other folk, actually escorts senior reporter Abigail Jones around town. She writes all about this in the article as well. Right. And then we decided to actually name our book that, but really tell a much fuller story on Murder Town USA. And just one, another take home point, if you will, nobody in the city of Wilmington or very few people and up to and including street identified populations or persons, right? They don't understand their city is Murder Town USA. And we also say that repeatedly throughout the book, right? So just keep that in mind. All right, really quickly, just to give some context, right? Keep in mind, a lot of the homicides and gun violence has migrated to small and medium-sized cities, particularly in this day and age, right? And as we can see, right, these are the three breakout years, 2010, 17, and 21, when Wilmington broke its homicide records, right? And as you can see, right, those homicide per capita rates are pretty high, particularly in the city of 71,000. To give us some context, big cities, right, where we see a drop, a giant drop, if you will, dramatic drop in the shooting and gun violence, right? And when I was growing up, there were probably 2,000 homicides per year in New York City, right? On any given year, you know, that's a big year right there, right? But somewhere between 300 to 500 homicides, and or it's hovering between 5 and 6 homicides per 100,000. Chicago is actually in a 25-year low. Media is not research. They're just reading from a teleprompter. So we're going to share just some briefly some quick stories, and we ground the book in a bunch of stories to help us tell a much larger story, particularly around structural violence. Herman Curry was the first person that I met, right, by myself through my friends in Delaware. And he was the first person that I actually met that got shot and killed. And his story reveals a lot. Herman Curry is actually Jamaican. And one of the cases that we make in Murdertown, USA, keep in mind, neighborhoods, communities, for the most part, are organized around racial, ethnic designations. Neighborhoods, for the most part, don't do race. They don't do people of color, and they don't do black and brown. I don't have anything against that, right? But in a place like New York City, for instance, it's not brown communities. It's Dominican, it's Puerto Rican, right? And so forth and so on. Keep in mind, right, Herman Curry is getting into it with Otis Phillips. It's an amazing story. Don't have a whole lot of time to talk about it now. He goes on a run for about 4 or 5 years after killing Herman's friend. Herman's willing to testify against him, although he's in the streets. They're most part of the Wilmington Sure Shot Jamaican gang. To the outsiders, it's just black people killing black people. To the folk inside Wilmington, it's a beef amongst the Jamaicans. The communities are understanding it differently than the way you and I may write about it. And I learned a lot about the Jamaican presence in the streets of Wilmington through Herman's story. Now, one of the things that we mentioned that we need to do a much better job of is tracking social intensity of the homicides. Bear with me. I know there's a lot here, but there's a message here, right? And for us, and we write, most in the streets were not victimized by extreme violence, nor did they routinely perpetrate violence. Instead, most struggled with chronic exposure, right, to the violence, the effects of which were likely heightened in a small city. One vicious incident in Wilmington was enough to permeate its social environment for weeks. The social intensity of the homicide sometimes outgrew the actual demography of Wilmington's violent crime rates. A single homicide sometimes had more impact than 3 to 5 homicides over the same 6-week period, particularly if the victim was well-known or in the streets or considered to be an unfortunate or undeserving victim. So the homicides, there were particular homicides that rocked Wilmington to its knees. Mr. Chambers.
Yes. So the violence that happened in Wilmington during the Street Power Project, we were not exempt from it. And there were several deaths that took place that actually rocked the foundation of our Street Power Project. And what we learned quickly was that every homicide in Wilmington was measured a little differently. There were some homicides that actually rocked the neighborhood to its core, and it had a lasting impact on the community, and it actually went to as far as it created laws or it changed policy. One day, my second week of graduate school, I'm down at Barnes & Noble's. I'm studying Marx, and I'm telling you, I don't know what's going on. All I know is lost capital and something about somebody being exploited. So as I'm driving up the 95, which is our main corridor, I get a phone call. And the phone call says, hey, someone has been shot. So at the time, I was part of a response team that I respond within every shooting in the city within the first 48 hours. So I drop my books and I run over there. And as I run over there, I see blood stained on a door, and I see the paramedics frantically working on this young man. And as I go to approach him, I see his mother crying in the bushes. And they miraculously got this young guy together. They put him in the ambulance, and we followed him down there. And as I got his mother into the car, we got down there, and we settled down there. About 5 minutes later, the alarm goes off, and I see all of the doctors running for the cold. 5 minutes later, they called the cold off. And at that point in time, I turned to his mother and I said, honey, know that our son is dead. And the room went silent. And as the word started to get around the room, people wanted to extract revenge. And they came to me and they said, well, let's go back to the streets. Let's go kill his mother. Let's go kill his father. Let's go kill the neighbors, the dogs, the insects. Let's just go kill everybody. And at that time, not really thinking, I said, let's go. But his mother, on my way out, she grabbed me. And she said, hey, let me ask you a question. If you was a conductor of a train and you had 250 young men behind you, depending on you to make a good decision, and you know for sure that if you turn left, that everybody in that train was going to die, including yourself, would you turn left? I said, no, don't make sense. Come on, I don't got time for this. I got to go revenge my son now, though. She said, but what happened if you had the ability to turn right and only one person died and you can save the 249? Would you choose that option? I said, yes, that makes sense. She said, well, know that your son has died. And now it's your mission through the PAR project to create not a bloody revolution, but a spiritual, economic, a political, and a cultural revolution. So his life took on new meaning to us. And what we realized was that the PAR was not just a research project, it's a movement. Mm. And that's how we approach it. Yeah, sir?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So next up, another famous story for all the wrong reasons in Wilmington, Delaware, which we highlight, Ms. Jeremy Bam Bam McDowell. Not to compare pain, but this is the worst police murder I've ever seen in my life. Still on YouTube or social media for what it's worth. Gentleman was literally, he's a paraplegic, shot broad daylight. He was unresponsive, meaning he literally just wasn't responding to the police, right? And the fact that he's twitching, which paraplegics do, due to blood circulation, we write extensively about that. That was enough to trigger the police just to shoot him and kill him. That created a gigantic stir, if you will, in Wilmington, which led to a lot of protest and or what we ultimately describe as street agency. And eventually, right, in addition to the streets responding, in addition to grassroots organizers responding, you also had an uprising inside J.T. Vaughan Correctional Center. Keep in mind, J.T. Vaughan is part of a 10-year set of uprisings inside prisons that are virtually kept off of mainstream media. Delaware joins that in February of 2017. 3 COs were kidnapped, and one of those COs were killed. Right, and we write extensively about this story, and or it speaks to street agency, right, and or the uprising for the most part was motivated by the conditions and the sexual abuse of mostly male COs, male inmates by the COs, right? This was, and so keep in mind, they literally filed a lawsuit as well. The tail end of all of these uprisings will be the Wilmington iteration, particularly of the George Floyd uprisings. There were at least 2 to 3 uprisings in the city. And it should be underscored. It was Wolf and the team that's literally on the ground in the middle of all of this. We're doing a conference call. And at the end of the day, Wolf and Dare, or his brother Derek, right, who was on the conference call, they were just seriously committed to the people being safe. We're not going to let the police hurt any of them out here. We write extensively about one of those uprisings, particularly this night, and how they were literally on the ground keeping police from young people and or hurting or harming young folk. We would have a meeting with the attorney general, the mayor, and also the governor. They would want to meet with us. They met with us, about 5 of the Street PAR associates and about 30 members from the community, right? And they were meeting with us to stop the protests that we, in addition to a bunch of other community leaders, would organize. Street PAR is more than a research project. It's more than just data analysis. It is a movement, right? They cordoned off the city and everything, right? And it was raining. And as we can see, right, thousands still showed up. So keep in mind, us, you know, we're not the only one that organized this, but look at the kind of organizing and scholarship, right? Street PAR is a way to do all of this. Okay. Dr. Hitchens,
Oh, okay, sure. So what is street par in a nutshell? Street par is a par model that organizes street identified populations and or persons formerly incarcerated to do activism and empirically document the experiences of other street identified populations. Any population that you're interested in, homeless youth, mothers with children, right? Any population that you're interested in, drilling down into their lived experiences by adding those people onto the research team. So we take people who have experiences in the streets, people who have been incarcerated, people who have knowledge about violence and how it works in a city, and we add them onto the research project. And we add them in every part of the research project, right? So bringing the doctoral model to the street corner requires that we teach folks theory, that we teach folks research methods, like we literally take them through the minutiae of data collection and research methods.
Yeah. Quant and Qual in co-authorship as well, and they are paid for their experience. All right, this is the first cohort that we did in Wilmington, Delaware. 15 PAR members, 12 men, 3 women, between ages of, I think, 20 or 21 to about 40, right, was this first cohort. They're also joined by a robust partnership of 8 institutional partners, 3 universities, 5 nonprofits, right? This is the city of Wilmington. The yellow area of the map is the East Side and South Bridge, or the sections of the city in which we did this first study, Murdertown, USA, in. Our research methods training is rigorous. This training for this particular cohort, 3 months, first 2 months is 18 research methods workshop, 3 times per week for 3 to 5 hours per workshop. We then revisit the material in the 3rd month, and in the 4th month, we enter the field. This is theory. We first half of workshops begin with a whole set of workshops on learning theory and creating our framework. And one of the chief theories of the project is sites of resiliency theory. Crime as resilience, not that crime is a good thing. Nobody in the streets that we met with thought that. We are not arguing that. But this is the way that they're ensuring their survivability. And ultimately, gun violence for this project is a site of resilience. Again, we're not arguing that it's a good thing. Never met a shooter that thought also shooting or homicides in and of itself was a good thing. We also have this language in there, structural violence complex, which is drawing off of Johann Galtung's structural violence theory. Our ultimate argument is that the poverty, the extreme poverty, is highly predictive of the violence. Therefore, the interventions have to be grounded in responding to that inequality. We don't know anything that works better than material resources to actually bring the violence down. However, we try everything else first besides what we know works best. We hit the field. We collected nearly over 500 surveys. This is a quota sample between the ages of 18 to 35, Southbridge East Side. We collected nearly 50 participants, 3 different interview types across 3 different age groups. Some of the things that we're finding, nearly 70%. Keep in mind, structural violence is a main part of our argument. We found nearly 70% of the men between the ages of 18 to 35 in the Southbridge and East Side sections of Wilmington were unemployed. And nobody's losing any sleep behind this. You can go to one poor or low-income Black neighborhood after the next. Close your eyes, just pick one. This is what you're gonna find when you show up there. Everybody going to sleep, including all of the good people who smile all the time and speak good King's English, right? And pray. We're all going to sleep with all of this going on. Women aren't that far behind. So in general, about 2/3 of our sample were unemployed. We also found that about 100% of the Black males in South Bridge were dropping out of school. That's literally impossible. We told the governor's office that. That would violate every statistical law that we know of. There's no 100% of any population that does any one thing. The only way you get a number like that is if it's being orchestrated. That's the only way you get that number. All right. Then soon after that, Barack Obama would place Wilmington and/or the Christina School District under a federal investigation, one of 5 school districts in the country under federal, just like we told the governor was going to happen. Because anytime you start seeing 60, 70, 80, 90% of any population doing anything that's structural, that's beyond individual choice.
So, and then too, if we drill down into the home life, if you really think about the home life of some of the folks who are in the streets in our interviews, right? Leslie tells us that, at least in her experience, there were cracks in the walls, the ceiling started to leak in the kitchen and the dining room area, the drains were clogged, the refrigerator, like pieces were missing on the side, right? So if you really go into the homes of some folks and you see how people are living, you can understand how the streets become viable.
Again, most people in the streets, and I know you all know this, but let's just say it out loud anyway. Most guys in the streets, contrary to social media, that's not research. Media is not research neither, mind you, right? Traditional media. Most folk in the streets are actually not violent as a form of identity. Most folk are willing to engage in what's sometimes described as situational violence, though, right? But that group that's violent as a form of identity, that's a small group. Even in the streets, less than 1% of Black America is responsible for all of its crime. Less than 1 to 5% of any city is responsible for all of its crime or violence. But what did they really talk to us a lot about in terms of what they were struggling with? Exposure to violence. They all pretty much said, no, we're saturated with that. Hearing about it, seeing it, knowing about, right, someone being hurt, harmed, or killed. About 55% had a relative killed with a gun. About 60% had a friend killed with a gun. Byron, kicked out by his parents, kicked out by his mom. His father denied paternity of him, kicked out by his mom when he was 13 years old in his underwear, his t-shirt in the middle of the rain. And him and his friends were one of the toughest, but you know, it was cool interviews we did. We did a group interview with him, then we interviewed Byron by himself. But he helps us to understand, right, sleeping on the back porch, asking for covers and blankets, not having much to eat, that's what turns you into a killer. Huss helps us to understand, although most are not going through repeated experiences of victimization, most of the guys in our sample and women are not going through that. But you do have a small subsample that is. Huss got shot, right? And he just talked about how it impacted his psychological well-being, going from 235 to 30 pounds to 95 pounds. He talks about the look. He talks about how it impacts his emotional and psychological well-being as well. Most of the guys in the streets, right, are not repeatedly harmed, contrary to the media. I know you know that. Our data also supports that. 75% said they've never been stabbed, right? To be in this sample, you have to be active in street culture. 75% of them said they've never been stabbed before. They don't know, but a small subsample, 8%, repeatedly has. Hold on, 80%, and these are the crack cocaine dealers, so to speak. Well, 80% of them said they've never been shot with a gun. We don't know what you're talking about. No, TV says something different, I know. And the backroom conversations say something different. But when you're actually in the neighborhoods, right, this is a truer representation of what they're going through. You do have a small subsample, right, that is repeatedly going through that, though. Now, we do a whole chapter on street love. I think that's chapter 9. And Abigail Jones from Newsweek, who wrote the story, Murder Town, right, she said, I love your data, but the data that jumps out the most to me is this data that you're collecting on psychological and social well-being, what we are calling street love. She couldn't believe it. So what are we arguing? We're arguing that guys, women, boys, girls, men and women in the streets love themselves. They love their families. They love their children. They love their communities. They believe in God. They want to work. They want to go to school. And I'm talking about the crack cocaine dealer and or the shooter. And we have data to support it. 83% said that they were satisfied with their life. 85% said that they were happy these days. About 93, 94% said they were a useful person to have around. These are the crack cocaine dealers. When I was training as a doctoral student, I trained in psychology, right? So there we really called them delinquents and deviants and maladaptive. These are all the catchphrases that they had low self-esteem. They were suffering from Black self-hatred. Black people said this. Lord have mercy. Look at how all the good people, right? That's you and me, by the way. Look at how we talk about them. And we're the only research group in the country that can systematically get on the ground, collect the data to even test the thesis. And I remember Abigail Jones, she was speaking to me, right? She says, you know, I just want to be honest. I just want to be transparent. I made a bunch of phone calls around the country to see if this is, because I didn't know if I could believe this. Whoever she spoke to, I'm not sure, they all supported our findings. When you go inside these neighborhoods, you hang around the shooters, the drug dealers, or you go inside the prisons, you're not gonna find a whole bunch of guys walking around all glum and their head down. And these are some of the most optimistic people on the planet. And your interventions need to reflect that temperament. 76% of our sample said they felt the responsibility to make their community better. See, street par is threaded through these findings. Because if that's true, that means we can work with them in all kinds of magical ways. And it is true. Both and is going on, right? Okay, well, I know we got to hurry up. Time is of the essence. right? And this is just a little bit of language. Banks just talking about how a number of guys from his neighborhoods gave back to his neighborhood. He doesn't justify or excuse it, right? But also a lot of these guys in interviews are arguing that they're out competing the service providers and the academics. They're doing more to help in the neighborhoods than the people who get paid to do that. That's you and me, by the way. The irony that the community is going to them before they go to us. I don't know if y'all want to jump in. We're in the activism action part of this.
So activism is a piece that we often miss as academics, even the community-based ones or community-engaged ones. But with Street Par, we take activism very, very seriously. And we think about it at multiple levels, right? So we're taking Street Par members to conferences. We're helping folks build their own nonprofits. We're helping PAR members get involved in the things that they want to be involved in. So this is just some photos as a reflection of it. They're violence interrupters.
When we recruit people for the PAR team, there's three things that we find essential that a PAR member must have. The first one is that they got to have social capital. So what do I mean when I say social capital? Not just that they're good people who can go around and just talk to folks. No, what I'm saying, who has the intellectual ability to navigate through our communities that is naturally distrustful of new people coming inside their neighborhood, asking them damn questions, right? So how do you find that person to actually come there, right? Who they trust and who's able to open up? Because what the research says that when you're able to have someone from that targeted population on the research team, your data is more valid and it's more reliable. So that's our number one thing. You got to have social capital. The second one is lived experience. Now, I'm not saying that you got to be the number one gun boy. You had the most robberies in the last 10 years. I'm not saying you sold the most perks. I'm not saying that you take Xannies or anything. What I am saying is that you got to be in a position to where that you're not going there being judgmental. Because people can feel that, right? Our people are good at really recognizing personalities and individuals. And the last one is that you got to have sweat equity. What's sweat equity? Sweat equity is simply this, that you can't come there as a disaster capitalist. You can't come there thinking that your main goal was that you're going to profit off the back of the poor. So our thing is that you got to really believe that the mission overrules the money. The mission overrules the money. Because we got a saying where we're from, that whenever the rule getting in the way of the mission, don't change the mission, bend the damn rule. Right? So this right here, an example right here of us with social capital. We was given short notice that Governor Markell wanted to do a barbershop tour. He's the white man with the bald head. That's Governor Markell. And the guy right there with the scully on, like he robbed somebody, that's our mayor. And our mayor was upset that we had a couple hours to get this right here together. And we were able to organize this tour for the governor. So the mayor wrote a bonus and said, I don't know what made y'all come here without telling me. So this right here, just us out here getting the community together, because we really wanted to give the community a sense that you do got access to some of these public officials. Okay, yeah.
Okay, man the box. So we also involve in policymaking, creating legislation and laws. We worked on, we're pivotal in regard to the city-based man the box legislation, which went through, and then also at the state level as well 2 years later. We're now, we worked on a bunch of legislation, but the latest one is on compassionate release. We've been working really hard in getting guys out of prison. We just got a gentleman out who did 54 years in prison for, wait for it, attempted robbery. They were just gonna leave him in jail for life for attempted, he didn't even rob anybody. Right. And I couldn't believe it. I didn't think it was real. I mean, all of it, we did. But when we found out, we got to work. He's out now. He's home with his family. And now we have just filed new legislation on compassionate release in Delaware. So we do traditional action and activism as well. Right. We also do art shows. Art is a great way to be loud. And these are two flyers for the same event. We identified 50 local artists to debut their work in a high-end art center. And our art show was around gun violence and inequality. And they produce, 50 local artists produce 276 pieces of art. Fits about 500 people. The first night, 1,000 showed up. Very interactive art exhibition. These are real images of Blood gang members from Newark, New Jersey. We also released a documentary called The People's Report. Thousands have come out to watch it. And this is the last big story we'll share. I know we got to get to Q&A. I'm so sorry. But one of the stories, one of the gripping stories, we think, in Murdertown, USA, story that speaks to agency, street agency, right? It was a story that took place in Dolores J. Baylor Women's Correctional Institution. Long story short, they would bring me in the Inside Out program, and I would meet them. And I remember writing in Murder Town, and when I first met them before presenting, the women kind of surrounded me a little bit and were talking to me about PAR, and they wanted to know more. And right, they were really curious about my experiences with city and state leadership and the politics I had to navigate. And I said, man, okay, cool. Then they even suggested in the conversation a little bit that they were doing their own study inside Baylor, but they were kind of quiet and they would giggle. And, you know, all that was going on in this moment. And I said, okay, well, at the end of these courses, right, there's kind of like a closing out ceremony, which kind of feels like a graduation. I would get invited to that. This was really big event. This was like a graduation in the auditorium. The new warden was there, Wendy Capel. Probably about 100, 150 people attended, city, state leadership, family. And in the middle of the schedule, the program, they broke from the schedule and they decided to start presenting, unbeknownst to everybody else, results from their study on sexual assault from the COs inside Baylor. And they surveyed, I think, about 150 women in the facility, which fits about 400. Keep in mind, most of the women in there are pre-trial detainees. Most of them are actually not convicted of a crime. And this is the only prison, right? Only one prison for women in Delaware. So they would present these results. Delaware is, right, very nice. So we just smiled. I was laughing, but we just smiled while they were presenting, right, all of this graphic, this detail, right? And keep in mind, at the end of the day, so about 40% of the women who filled out the survey said that they were sexually assaulted, and about 95, I believe, percent of the women, they said that at the end of the day, they didn't want to even call out any of the COs because they understand retribution, right? But what they wanted was access to condoms so they don't get pregnant and or get a venereal disease. That's all they wanted. So we were stunned. Again, quiet. I'm smiling like in the affirmative. Obviously, if they would have known, they wouldn't have let that presentation happen. And they were smart enough, meaning now the facility, know that you're not going to stop them and embarrass them and stop us hearing all of this. Not in front of all of these, right, leaders from the community. So they had no choice. The women hijacked the moment. They also, right, at the end said that, you know, they were inspired to do this as a function of the Wilmington Street PAR program. They now understood the power of data. They also understood how academics were not using their data to fight for them, how we would be afraid to do that. But their own study and their own data, right, ultimately led to one of the largest lawsuits, right, for sexual assault inside a correctional facility. And the average academic, we would be scared of that. If they told us that, we would go, oh, right? That's what we would do. I'm just being honest, right? And they saw what research could do for them. Even if they would be sacrificial lamb, what would come after would be a new world, so to speak, or a new way, at least in some instances, for the women that would come after. And that was all worth it. Major, there were a number of COs. He became the face of the case, though. A number of the COs just quit outright. They had been doing this for years. This issue with sexual assault inside facilities, including the male facilities, right, probably takes place in most prisons to some extent. Keep that in mind. It's one of our country's most quietly kept secrets. This is happening all throughout the country. All right, we got to wrap this up. This has led to a bunch of other projects. This is our next major project, Christiana Care Hospital. Right now we go from 500 surveys to 800 surveys. Again, quota sampling. Right, we collected a bunch of blood pressure data. We also collected over 100 interviews and so forth and so on.
The last day of President Joe Biden, he gave me a pardon along with Marcus Garvey. And one of the things that he cited was my contribution to Murdertown USA and how some of the changes that I was able to make within the city of Wilmington and state of Delaware by working with Dr. Yasser Payne and Dr. Hitchens on the PAR project. So it was like a crowning moment. And, you know, I'll be forever grateful because the president recognized that PAR is a movement.
Yeah.
It's a revolution. Yeah. And it's something that we got to keep going. So we're trying to unionize this, y'all, throughout the country now. I'm telling you, we need everybody on this right here. When we're able to take the graduate research model and take it to our informational hubs, so to our barbershops, to our beauty salon, to our street corners, to our recreational sites, our community centers, even in the alleyways where they're selling the crack at, take that graduate research model right there. Why? because we have to tell our own story, and the people who are being talked about should be the ones controlling the narrative.
Run doing very well. Also got his doctorate. We have a site now in Philadelphia where we're collecting a lot of data, and we have a PAR team there as well. Right. One of our big arguments towards the end of the book and throughout, though, right, the racial wealth gap, structural violence. As we can see, right, the average white family today has about $122,000 in the bank. The average black family has about $1,200 in the bank. I take this data to the team and to the neighborhoods. The only thing they said, wow, this is very illuminating, very revealing. However, Yas, one question we have, I said, what's that? We don't know anybody in the projects that had $1,200 in the bank. Now, $1,200 to you and I doesn't sound like a lot, but where we're at doing the work that we do, most of the people there make less than $15,000 per year. Everybody going to sleep too, that's including the good people. As a result, right, Wolf, a number of Wolf is on the actual Black Reparations Committee. I presented our data to the committee. Dr. Ann Aviles was part of our family. She presented the housing data as well. And Wolf is on the actual committee that's been organized by City Council. So we take this very seriously in Delaware, also in Philadelphia too. Again, five takeaways, right? No YOS scenario, smallest in the country, small city size predictive of gun violence. Three, we cannot police, incarcerate, and gentrify our way out. We need a Black reparations plan, number four. And number five, we leave you with more PAR and street PAR. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much for really orienting us with this work and doing such powerful work. I think some of my questions are really just selfish, but still on theme with the symposium. You know, one thing that I find powerful is even for, you know, scholars who are doing community-embedded work, who are conducting research and then trying to present it back to the community, this takes it to another level. When I was reading the book and thinking about just like the skills that the people in the community are really receiving and thinking about the people who I interact with who deeply desire those skills. And then to see that you guys recruited, put out a call for the position, got 150 applicants for 15 positions. And so I really just wanted to give you guys the opportunity to talk about, you know, what does it look like to build that curriculum? How do you manage? Because, you know, I think that's a beautiful thing to have 150 people interested, but then it's probably also heartbreaking to say, we only have space for 15. What does it look like for someone who hasn't done street PAR to move in this direction and do that work? How do we get this to grow?
Okay, cool. So the way we kind of thought about it was this. Now, mind you, we did get 150 applications, but we had to shut down the application process after about a week, right? So we would have left that open for a month or so. The need, the poverty, the unemployment rates are so high, and folk want to work. The way we kind of organized the curriculum and everything, so probably 2008, top of 2009, me and Wolf and I are getting to know each other, right? He's introduced to me through one of the partners, and we have to spend a lot of time around each other. And Wolf really needs me to explain to him in clear ways, like what we're doing. I had been doing this work in New York City before coming down to Delaware. And Wilmington is small, and Wolf has a lot of social capital. But he's not gonna allow me or anybody to leverage that capital unless it's authentic, right? So prior to any of this beginning, Wolf and I just had to spend time. We had to talk. We had to have marathon conversations on the phone. I had to come down to the neighborhood. You know, he'd take me to the barbershop. He'd take me here. Sometimes he'd just throw me out there, let me talk while he listened, you know. And that had to happen, and it had to be authentic. He got his questions answered and before he could actually give me the green light. Now, once that happened, funding's in place, everything is teed up. Then at that point in time, right, particularly when we start recruiting, put it out through social media, but be honest with you, nothing actually beats boots on the ground. So once all that came in, right? So we got the 150, we did bring in 75 for half a day, right? And from that 75, we then recruited 30 or identified 30 for individual interviews. And then from that 30, we identified 15. But throughout the process, Wolf is actually paying attention to who these applicants are. To the outsider, they're just names on a paper. At the end of the day, we can't have 15 people in the room who have history with each other, right? And there's no way for me to know that. He knows that. He would know also how they would meld. Even if they read good on paper, he understood them, right, outside of the paperwork, right? So having that kind of person in the room to verify and ultimately decide, he ultimately decided the 15 in terms of who would actually work. Not to mention, He's the senior research associate on the team. That means he's the leader. He, you know, he makes sure people get paid or not. He's monitoring everything from A through Z, but he's the senior research associate on that project. But that's how we went about pulling the team together.
I love that.
But I would add this right here is that we were very skeptical because here go a guy that's priming pie in the sky and he's from New York City, so he's talking fast. So we watching him, right? Because I'm from Slowtown, Delaware, and he's talking awful fast. So we watches him. The one thing that sometimes we don't give people on the street credit for is that they have great, what I call instincts, right? Mm-hmm. So their stomach talks to them a lot and their gut tells them certain things about certain people. So I'm saying, okay, well, I'm going to give him a chance and I'm going to see if he's a man of who he say he is. And sure enough, he proved himself to be that. And as I started introducing him to our social informational hubs, something unique happened that I didn't know was going to happen is that my trust started to transfer. So after about 6, 7, 8 times of taking him to these barbershops or to the beauty salon, he was able to go by himself. Now there's something connected to that too, because now that's going to allow him to bring the next group of people in. And they're going to say, well, we trust you because we trust Yasser and we trust Wolf. So if something go wrong, it all comes back to me. So, right, I'm letting Yasser notice, hey, man, don't bring nobody in our space without letting the people know whether or not they're friend or their foe. Because NPR came through and they wanted to do an interview. At first, it was going to go to the neighborhoods, but we're unionized down there in Wilmington. So we tell people, even University of Delaware, you're not doing no community-based research unless you come to us first. People don't talk to them unless they come to us first, because we're not going to let you be the control of our narrative anymore. So as we got permission to go down there and talk to them, we told the people, hey, if they ever come back without us, don't talk to them. And we actually told that to NPR. So they went down there, they did an interview, and 3 days later, they tried to sneak back down in the neighborhood. And sure enough, soon as they pulled up, they called us. And we went down there and told NPR that the interview's over and we won't, I'm saying, you got to get out of here. But that level of trust between the researcher and those being researched and those on the research team had never been established before until you came down there and introduced the PAR project.
One of the things that we try and teach the neighborhoods, right, through Street PAR is their narratives, their story, their data. And we literally say this is a multi-billion dollar market, particularly for the researchers alone. So one of our goals is to really inform communities, marginalized communities, of the value of their information. And then also, right, equip them with a skill set to draw on that value. And they don't understand, like, how a lot of us, they become cash cows, not only for us in terms of our bank accounts, but also, like, in general, for our careers. So I tell Wolf all the time, in terms of, do you know how many careers you have helped? Beginning with mine, with graduate students, undergrad students, faculty, the data that they're able to get one project after the next, right? And so my point is, it's very important for them to not only understand the value of the data, but to also be able to say no. And I'm an academic, I'm from New York, lights, camera, action. And keep in mind, Wilmington, as we write a lot about, Murdertown, USA, small city culture, particularly in the Black neighborhoods, there's a strong Sunni Muslim, right, segment of the Black community. Humility is a big cultural feature or trait in the Black community in Wilmington, right? Moving around fast, TV, all of that, being on front page, that's not as valued. And I'm an academic, right? We want to get our stuff out there. That's not as valued with them. So yes, they will say no to a major or not so major media outlet. And they don't believe it. The media outlet doesn't believe it. You're saying no, they have no problem with that. For them, the goal or the grand award is the community itself. And I learned a lot from that throughout my time in Wilmington.
So I will say, you stole my thunder on my follow-up.
Oh, Jesus.
But I just want to quote, I just want to quote you anyway, because I think that is such a powerful takeaway. And I think it has been overlooked for so long, the way that Black people, marginalized people, are not reaping the benefits of the work that's being done and are unaware of how these systems profit off of them. And so I just found it particularly powerful for you to explicitly say this in the book, to say that the data on poor Black people are invaluable. Residents have been trained on how to access it, analyze it, and profit from their own information. So yes, I just want to thank you guys for that because that's so important. So I think in the work that I've done in the community, people are often unaware of the magnitude of oppression and systemic oppression they are under. And so I'm curious if you find that street par, you know, actually opens their eyes to how much of their circumstances is out of their control. As researchers, we have this bird's eye view, consider things from the aggregate and then really hone in on what's important, right? And so, but when I talk to people in community, they don't have that information. They haven't been trained. They haven't participated in a street par. So they don't know that, you know, there are ways to understand how systemic oppression, structural violence contributes to their experiences. And so I'm curious if you hear them explicitly identifying and acknowledging the ways in which these systems exist.
Well, the crazy thing is they might not have the language that we all use or value, the jargon that we use in academia, but they know that something's underfoot. I think they also think that we know when we care. And I think the reality is that so many of us don't. Mm-hmm. So, and broadly, I would say they know that something's underfoot. They know that there's oppression happening. They might not know the King's English or all the jargon that we use. But more importantly, they think that we are aware of it. In a nutshell, they think that there are more people who are on their side and are trying to do the work of justice when the reality is that many of us are not in the academia. So.
Piggyback off that, I think that Brooklyn, you're right on, is that they don't have the academic language, and it might not say it as what we call eloquent as someone down at the University of Delaware might say. But let me call your attention to that second video when you see this the first day of data collection. Do you know that our instrument was 45 pages? Our instrument was 45 pages. It took 1 hour and 20 minutes to complete that survey. And I'm telling you, if it wasn't because of the sun and the way that the moon rotated, we would have got all 800 surveys that day, because that's how many people we had to turn away. So when you have that person with that social capital, that person who they trust, because when they see me, Yasser, and some of our team members, they know that something's good going on. They know that some useful information is about to be dispensed. So they actually come to it. So one of the things that we even teach our youth, we say, according to Adam Smith, there's something called the law of supply and demand. So when I'm down at the University of Delaware talking to the president, he's talking about young Black and brown kids. Their voices are not there. When I'm talking to the governor, the county executive, or even the mayor, they're talking again about young Black and brown boys between the ages of 14 and 25, but they're not there. When I go to the nonprofit sector or the philanthropic community, the same thing happened there. So we sit down and we explain to our kids, hey, what happens when you have something that everybody wants, but there's no supply for it? You're the only one that got it, but it's in high demand. Michael Jordan, last pair of sneakers. You're the only one got them. How much is it worth? They say, oh man, big bucks. I get a whole lot of stuff with that. Millions, millions. I said, that's how you got to recognize your voice. Your voice is a commodity. And you got to treat it as such. Because truth is, we live in a capitalist society. And I'm telling them that there's other people profiting off of it. So we slowly begin to introduce the language to them. And then you'll see them later on talking to their friends or even talking on the phone to their parents, like introducing them to what structural violence means. We got kids right now, because we got our youth power project, where we actually got kids talking about structural racism. They're talking about social bond theory. They're talking about the learning perspective. Actors and all them, like I'm talking about, like they're really on it to the point that now it's becoming contagious. I call it poor COVID.
We teach, right? So in the end of the book, we make, I think, 5 recommendations, one of which is a structural violence campaign. In these ongoing YPAR workshops, in addition to other community kinds of workshops that we do, we're teaching them these theories: site resiliency theory, structural violence theory, critical race theory. We're teaching these to young people. And older, but young people, right? Letting them know what we're teaching in the universities. But more specifically, to answer your question, so they need the language. We need to give their concerns form. What are we actually letting them know, right? We teach them Franz Fanon. Oh man, they love these ideas.
They didn't know he was talking about all this stuff. But keep in mind, one of the things, what are we really letting them know? Right, we get behind the jargon. Right? One of the things we let them know is this. You are the out-group. That's Derrick Bell. He's the founder of critical race theory. He wanted all Black Americans descended of the slave South to know, as we write at the end of the book. We are the out-group. Michelle Alexander, she's a critical race theorist in the same spirit of Derrick Bell. What did she say in this speech? Black America, that has always been your job since slavery, to be the out-group. You need a group, an out-group at scale, too. We're 40 to 45 million strong, right? What do we write at the end of the book? 10% of Black Americans now, right, are hoarding 75% of the group's wealth. We write that in the last chapter. All groups are doing that, by the way. That means 90% of our group lives on 25% of our wealth. That means the vast majority of us aren't doing well. The overwhelming vast majority, I think something like 6%, according to one citation, I think it's Pew, don't get me the line, but 6% of Black America makes more than $100,000.
Yeah, I believe that's the statistic.
2053, we will be $0 in wealth. Right, and we dancing, Jay-Z, Beyonce. I don't know what we partying for. You may like Jay-Z, I'm sorry. But 2053, right? The average Black family has $1,200 in the bank. I don't know, what? Right? This is what we're teaching in the neighborhood so they can understand their structural oppression, if you will. You are out, that's what we say. And don't fall apart, don't get angry, don't be pessimistic. We just need you to understand what's going on and how, as we repeatedly write throughout the book, wealth is cultivated out of your entrenched poverty. In fact, we cannot have the privilege that we are experiencing, us or anyone in this room, if we didn't have tens of millions of people in the United States of America who could barely hold on. You cannot have one without the other. That's what we're teaching in the neighborhoods. So it goes beyond this kind of abstract, theoretical kind of idea that's way up here somewhere. And now the idea, we bring it right here so that it's accessible. And I need you now to understand your poverty, your failing schools, how all of it's been socially engineered by the good people who smile all the time, who speak good King's English, who pray all the time, who speak softly. They too can go to sleep at night with all of this madness going on. And wake up in the morning and call himself a good person. I don't even know what that means anymore. And we do say this repeatedly in our speeches. If you can go to sleep with all of this going on at night, then you are part of the problem. Whoever you are, that's including the Black people too, right? It's not until you and I recognize it to be the problem that it is, that it actually stops. And there's a way out, right? We're optimistic. Keep that in mind, too. Street Par is a movement that's grounded in optimism.
Thank you so much. All right, so we have about 20 minutes left. And so I want to open it up to questions. And so if you have any questions for our powerful authors, you can go ahead and walk up to the mic. We'll give you guys a few seconds to become brave.
I think I have an obvious question. First of all, my name is Caroline Light. I study Stand Your Ground laws and racial capitalism. I love, you make my heart sing when you talk about reparations. So what would that look like? What are some of the, I don't want to do a spoiler alert, I guess at the end of the book, you probably talk about this and I can't wait to read it. But can you talk a little bit about what are the concrete reparations that you're recommending?
Yeah, great question. I mean, just really quickly, I would say some of the leading scholars in this area, actually economists, right? So you have economists that have finally come together in the 2000s because they finally have access to wealth data. That's recent. Finally have access to wealth data. And they're able to really test Derrick Bell's critical race theory. So they're now today, right, the racial wealth gap scholars, which are economists providing the empirical evidence for critical race theory. That's why both receiving so much attention and or the Black reparations movement is receiving the attention that it does. At the end of the book, what we ultimately call, and I would say William Darity, in his works, he has a book that he writes with his wife, he's at Duke, right? And then they come out with an edited book too. Some of the finest works I've seen on laying out what the plan looks like. In short, Black reparations is a multi-trillion dollar package, right? On the lighter end, I've seen 14, 15 trillion, right? And I've seen estimates as great as, 30 or 40 trillion, A lot of folk would argue somewhere. So at the end of the day, it can come in a comprehensive package, but one of the key elements of a reparations plan is cash in hand, right? So the reparation activists are making that particularly clear, right? And or not only cash incentives or cash payments, but also attributed to Black Americans descended of the slave South, right? So Black reparations is not a racial program. It's not reparations for Black people. That's illegal. You can no longer do that, right? But it is lineage or ethnicity or ethnically based. That can move legally. That's part of the reason why Black reparations doesn't easily go away, because it doesn't matter. It does, but it doesn't necessarily matter if you agree with it. It's a legal issue or legal matter that has a lot of precedent in the US. So there are lots of other groups in the country that have received and still receive monetary reparations. That's why it's not easily removed. You also have lots of cases or instances of reparations throughout the world, world history and or currently, right? In terms of different creative, clever kinds of packages. But at the very least, it is a multi-trillion dollar package. And one of its priorities is cash payments to those that are descended of the slave South.
How would we respond to folks that say, maybe in this room, hopefully not in this room, but would say that, you know, cash isn't the answer. You can't trust people with cash. Cash won't solve the unemployment issue. All those kind of the counter arguments that people have about giving people cash incentive.
Great question. Reparations initiative or program is not designed to solve racism. It's not designed to respond to how you feel. It doesn't matter what they do with their money. Nobody asks, for instance, Jewish people when they receive their, what are you going to do with your money? Nobody said to the Native Americans when they receive their reparations, or the Japanese, I can't give it to you until you prove to me what are you, the assumptions behind the questions reveal exactly actually what's going on. And reparations is never contingent on that. This is a legal, I can spend my money on Michael Jordan's the next day. So what? It's my money. It was stolen. And the case, legal case, is being made for it to be returned. Our ultimate argument is that many of the problems that the Wilmingtons of the world are going through, or the Wilmingtons of the country in particular are going through, particularly the Black American segments, a lot of those issues, poverty, gun violence, substance abuse, et cetera, is born out of the structural violence complex. You cannot have a society that's created a system, right, to entrench a particular segment of the population into intergenerational poverty. That is illegal and unconstitutional. Not to mention, right, build its entire wealth system off of the free labor of Black slaves. And then everybody just walk around and say, it's all good. Hey, we gotta move on. That has to be compensated for. Keep in mind, there's no, and I hate to compare pain, I really do, right? But there is no tragedy that a people have experienced that is worse than chattel slavery for almost three centuries. No people on the planet have ever experienced anything like that before, have even come close to it, in fact. So I know I hear these responses all the time, but reparations is compensating for, right, this Holocaust.
Hi, Laura Vargas. Thank you so much for your presentation. I really enjoyed it. And congratulations, Mr. Chambers, on your pardon. Well, some of the discussions that we have are about guns as commercial products, right? They are products that are sold like Coca-Cola, like anything else, but that they inflict disproportionate harm in Black and brown communities. I mean, the same could be said for about like social media that makes some people very, very rich and then inflicts disproportionate harm on young people. So I wonder if you have these conversations within your community about gun violence also as somebody is profiting off of the presence of these firearms in your community. And if not, just I'm curious, how do you apply sort of the structural, I don't know, intentionality of firearms being present in Black and brown communities and causing so much harm, so much more harm? I'm just curious on how you handle that.
So a lot goes through our mind when it comes to this question. Great question. I would say that. So interestingly enough, so particularly around some of the gun advocacy groups that were around and their different approaches to dealing with gun violence, But what I see is two major tracks, right? You kind of have gun violence that's done by illegal gun owners, so to speak, right? These are schools being shot up. Maybe a legal gun owner, their child or another adult in the home may get access to the gun. Yes, policy, and I think there are a number of things you can do there to reduce gun, that form of gun violence. The gun violence that we are a part of, right, the second track, so to speak, the folk that we're dealing with are never going to go to a store to buy a gun anyway. That's not going to happen. They're not going to get a license. Delaware is an open and carry state, mind you, right? So it's the fifth easiest state to actually purchase a gun. We just passed a law that where now it requires you to get a permit. In Delaware, you can literally, if you have a residency, go to a store, show your ID. They maybe do a 10-minute background check, if that. And you can purchase any gun that you want. Again, now that there's a permit, and now I think there's some restrictions on some of the assault guns. But at the end of the day, the folk that we're talking about, they're not going to be in a position to actually go to a gun. And if you're part of the underground economy, at some point, problems will be solved, rightly or wrongly, as a function of violence. That's inherent to the lifestyle. And as we repeat throughout Murdertown USA, for a lot of the men and women who are involved in gun violence, physical injury, incarceration, and or death is worth the risk. That's how extreme the poverty is. Where, you know, to act so, what are you really asking a gentleman to do, right? That's a young Black male from these communities, right? He to be in, to immerse himself and sustain himself in extreme poverty for the next 40 or 50 years and be okay with that. That's actually what we're asking them to do. And he would rather live high on the hog for 5 to 7 years, risk physical injury, incarceration, and or death, than to sit here for 40 or 50 years, right, in economic poverty, not to mention lose your standing, because we write a whole argument, this is Franz Fanon, no, on dignity. So what makes a person violent? This is Franz Fanon, when you have nothing else to lose, when your dignity is so low, when you lose all standing and respect, even by the women in your community, the families, your family, your children, you lose all respect. When you have no other way of solving your problem, that is when you're most predisposed to engage in gun violence. And so for a lot of the guys that we're dealing with, and women, right, because they're part of this as well, a lot of the guns that they're getting are actually stolen, at least in the ones that they argue in Delaware that they found, that they were able to trace back. A lot of those guns are stolen out of legal guns owners' homes, interestingly enough. So they say, I'm kind of questioning it a bit, but right now the data points in that direction. Thank you for that question.
Hi, thanks so much for all the amazing work that you're doing. Could you say more about structural violence, the poverty that you're talking about? How do we move beyond that? And, you know, I look at community gun violence. I've participated in listening sessions in New Haven and Bridgeport, which are similar cities in terms of poverty, gun violence, et cetera, to Wilmington. And, you know, one participant said, and this was a man who returned from incarceration, and he said, it's easier for me to get a gun than a job. Mm-hmm. And I love the idea of reparations. I mean, one of my colleagues on the project says, we as academics, we get all these grants. What if that grant money went to the communities instead of going to us, right? And then in New Haven, the big issue is Yale, which does not pay anywhere near market value for property tax. And I keep saying, if Yale paid reparation, if they paid a fraction of it to the communities, that they literally pay lots of money to put a bike lane for the students so they don't have to go through the gun violence hotspot neighborhoods. So how do, I guess I want something more concrete, because I feel like, you know, it's so overwhelming. And I love the idea of reparations, and whether it's, and I'm wondering if you're thinking from, you know, the government or like institutions like Yale, if you could just say more about some of that. I know that's a huge question, but.
I think Yale was also built by slaves. Yeah.
Exactly. And another reason they should engage in reparations.
Yes. And University of Delaware also was founded during the early 1700s. I believe slaves were used to build our university as well. I think Georgetown, or as they created a reparations program. I don't know how, you know, it's better than most, so I take it. But I think the first step actually to a well-organized reparations program and a way to respond to the poverty, right? Keep in mind, the poverty in some respects is de facto like a legal kind of thing. Capitalism requires poverty too. For the dollar to have value, you must have millions of people who don't have access. That's what gives it value, in fact, right? If everyone had $1 million, you know how this story is going to end, then the money would be worthless, right? So you have to stratify. Read the work of Doug Massey, right? His second book. His first book is very popular too, though, American Apartheid. But read that second book, which to me is really his crown jewel, Categorically Unequal, right? How stratification works in America. Beautiful argument. Economists write a lot about this as well, right? You and I may call it classes or something like that. There is a creation of class, right? What's the purpose of that? It creates value in the currency, right? So that means you're going to need a group not to have, you're going to need a group to be in the middle a little bit, you need this group, right? And then that actual gradation, if you will, is what's creating value in the currency, right? So it's kind of, and they socialize this in us even as early as little children with a lot of the games that we play, right? So what's the game with the chairs? Musical chairs, right? There we go. So many games operate like this. So what makes the game fun? Somebody doesn't have a chair. Right, and we all walk around, and you sit down, boom, and then we laugh at the person that's out. That's Black America, by the way. But the person that's out is what gives value to the game. If everyone had a seat, the game wouldn't be fun, right? We wouldn't. What are we running around these chairs for? It's only fun because somebody's out, right? That becomes a way to understand, an oversimplified way to understand our economy. So what am I saying? We need awareness, right? That's what Derek Bell says right now, right? We need awareness. I think the first step to truly understanding where we are at, two things. Johann Galtung talks about cultural violence, right? So he has structural violence, cultural violence, and direct violence. Structural violence theory is actually a theory about physical violence. That's actually what it's about. He's just saying structural violence is the most predictive variable in that model. But one of the things he wrote a lot about, Johann Galtung, before he died, was cultural violence. For him, that was very problematic. And we need to, as a society, get our heads wrapped around that if we want to reel the poverty in. Cultural violence just means how indifferent you and I are, how indifferent the good people are, right? I don't even need to start with the right. I start right here with the left. How you and I can just go to sleep and we wake up and we smile and we go, and all of it comes at, and we write this repeatedly in Murdertown, all of it is coming at the expense of the most marginalized. In fact, you and I cannot have the privilege that we enjoy, me too, without tens of millions of people being out. You cannot have both at the same time. Johann Galtung brings us attention to our cultural violence, how we can just go to happy hour, see the homeless guy, hop right over him, go right there and say, hey, how you doing? Like that, and that really bothered Johann Galtung, that we have lost our humanity. I think a more practical step in terms of Johann Galtung, we need to learn cultural violence. But the other thing we need to do more of, we need to join The Economist and start doing some real rigorous analysis on the racial wealth gap. That's what's actually turning the corner, the data. And as we argue at the end of Murdertown USA, not look at it in terms of race. Thomas Shapiro, who's a Jewish scholar at Brandeis, he's the one that actually coins the term racial wealth gap. But he said, though, right, particularly later on in this work, he says, if I could rename it, I probably would, because it's not the racial wealth gap. It's the racial ethnic wealth gap. That's what we write in Murdertown, right? So, for instance, people don't live in racial groups. They live in racial ethnic groups. The wealth that the Cubans may have, for instance, is not the same wealth that the Mexican-Americans or right, the Dominicans have, or the wealth that the Japanese and Chinese have, or not what the Samoans have and the Filipinos and the Cambodians have. But you and I easily lump that under Asian. That's all done by design. Or under Latino, that's all done by design. The other thing that we say in Murdertown USA, Black Americans have far less wealth than Caribbean or Black immigrants, right? But if we hide it under Black, if we collapse it all under Black, right, it conceals and hides our loss of wealth, which is why we do, that's why we're doing it. Because Thomas Shapiro, Jewish scholar at Brandeis, what became more revealing to him and The Economist were, hold on, look at the racial ethnic, oh my God, right? That was more revealing, right? So again, we're in a state of awareness. We need to learn about cultural violence. And I think we need to start doing more racial wealth gap analysis, right? And we did that in Wilmington. We actually brought William Darity and his team down, right? Then J.P. Chase Morgan would jump in there and they would take over the analysis.
But yes, part of our question was about also, what can we as researchers do, right? When it comes to these $1 million grants that we get, these big packages that we get as scholars, to give back. So if I get $1 million grant, but I'm running a quantitative analysis on crime and X community, what can I do with those dollars in a strategic way to help do my part to impact change?
Oh, you're asking me.
Yeah, what would you do? $1 million grant. I don't know how to do PAR. I mean, I want to give back. I want to be helpful.
Racial wealth gap analysis. At the end of the day, also immerse yourself in the neighborhoods. I think a lot of times when we don't have the answer, right? So I think the way I would deal with it is, I think the community, go to the community, immersion, which is one of the five recommendations, but the community will also, right, let you know exactly how to move forward. A lot of times we fail to engage the communities around questions that we don't have answers for.
Thank you. Okay, I think we have time for one more question.
Thank you guys again. I'm from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Wow. I look at some of the data that you guys put up there, almost mirrors, right? And as a grad student, I'm very familiar with participatory action research, and sounds great, and doing street participatory action research is a little bit different than what I've been trained. However, you stumped me when you hit your training and you said 3 to 5 times a week 3 hours.
3 to 5 hours.
Yeah, 3 to 5 hours, 3 times a week. I can't get my people to go to the poll once every 4 years. How do you get that type of participation amongst your people?
That's a great question.
I think that right there goes back to how you recruit, because can anybody in our neighborhoods, they don't have the relationships to go tell somebody, hey man, or hey young lady, that we have a project. And if you invest this time, sure, we're going to pay you. But at the end of it, you're going to have a skill set that's going to be valuable, and it's going to help you 3 or 4 years down the line, right? So everybody don't have that. So you got to start with recruitment first. And I think that when we were able to recruit certain people, then it was a little bit easier to bring that graduate model. Because think about it, that's a graduate seminar, right? 3 hours a day, once a week. And think about it, we're teaching theory, we're teaching methods, we're teaching survey design. So, right, we needed those long sessions. But it got to the point that even after we went through the 18-week course, there were still more desires that people wanted to be on certain teams, because it became contagious. That knowledge became contagious. I'm working with a lot of folks down there in Baton Rouge right now. Courtney, we're all part of what they call CVILA, the Community Intervention Learning Academy up there in Chicago. So we're all part of that right there. And I'm trying to, like I say, I'm trying to get them to get us down there so that we can come down there with that PAR design, so that we can teach the people who's on the street in your neighborhood with that social capital this research methodology, so that they can get the right people in. And now we won't have a problem with movements such as getting people to go vote. Because we can have a whole PAR design around, right? How do we get people to the polls?
Right.
Because we haven't done that.
Right.
Like now when they want someone to come to the poll, or they want to organize around a certain initiative, they come to the PAR team. Because now we act like the experts that we really are. But that right there is a gradual process. You know, some people don't like the layup line. But it was the layup line that produced Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant. They didn't just jump up one day and they would cope. No. So it's that constant and consistent messaging to the folks that gets people motivated to do some of the things that they don't want to do.
We write a lot about the Pygmalion effect, right? And or sometimes what's often referred to as teacher expectation theory. So we probably don't have a whole lot of time to talk about this, but I'm going to give the Boolean Cube version. All behavior is adaptive, including gun violence. All behavior makes sense, including someone smoking crack cocaine. So if someone's not voting, the better question is, why aren't they not voting? What is adaptive about this? Not that you're saying this, but not that they're dysfunctional. So one of the things they say at the University of Maryland in the ed department, who brings me down there a lot, learning is biological. Right, I know they have socialized and TV and all of that, and they'll be like, young black kids don't like learning and all. There's no empirical evidence to even support these claims. Right, we're one of the few research teams that are actually testing it, particularly in that population that they say doesn't want to learn. There's no, now they are doing poorly in school, that's true. But their attitudes towards learning is out the roof.
So acting white theory, which is created by John Ogbu, which falls on its the weight of itself, right? Because there's no empirical evidence. If we thought that, we would never do street par. Pygmalion effect, what is it? Basically, however the teacher or the authority figure feels about the class or the students, there's a correlation. That means if I don't really think you can do well in my class, guess what? Unconsciously, you and I are going to create the conditions where you're going to fail, even if you have a high IQ, whatever that means. Right? And the inverse, if I think you are really smart, but I really believe it, and if my class is rigorous on top of that, we're going to unconsciously create the conditions for you to excel. So we write a lot about this in chapter two, meaning the very way you think at the deep, right, structure of the personality, how you actually feel. Uh-oh, you can't hide that about these poor black children or these guys in the streets, right? So I knew they were brilliant, but I come from a neighborhood in Harlem where my mother and my father made sure they thought I would lose my humanity working on a PhD, that I would stop thinking like this. They thought that. My mom, she was so scared for me. But I truly believed in them, you know, and I'm not going to lie or exaggerate. If I don't think you're cut for it, you're not cut for it. But at the end of the day, if you want this, we got you, right? So I think it begins with us. We do a train the trainer when we have the grant money before we launch the project so we can drain ourselves of all of those biases and assumptions and all that negative analysis that the good people, that's you and me, that we have about all these people we presumably want to help. But you must begin with they do value learning. They love, it's biological, it's electric. I haven't found anything to spread more quickly or metastasize more quickly in a neighborhood. I'm talking about the marginalized ones, and I'm talking amongst the gang members than an educational intervention. But the educational intervention, the curriculum has to be developed with them. They have to be reading arguments, right? That means we gotta sift through the literature in such a way that it meets the cultural needs and desires of the group. That's hard work. To find the right journal articles that they would actually read and get, right? And you and I, not anyone in here, but folk like you and I, we don't want to do all of that. And when they inevitably, like we give them something that they inevitably just reject, we have the power of framing and we ultimately frame them as disinterested. They don't have a platform to respond to us. So whatever we say becomes the narrative. That is what's happening in most of our schools. Street par rejects this. Right. So I'm working with Wolf and the guys on the curriculum on identifying articles and everything prior to day one of the workshops. But that's the kind of hard work that you and I are going to have to start doing if we want to reverse this. Right. Keep in mind, these schools are socially engineered to fail and we need them to be the out group. They do value learning. They don't value learning a curriculum that's not going to help them meet their basic needs. By fourth grade, the black boys are going to start acting up, right? Because they realize this curriculum doesn't help them deal with the poverty or the fact that they're wearing the same thing 3 or 4 days in a row. The fact that this teacher's not helping them get something to eat. And they get mad at them when they don't do their homework. Like this kid is going to be like, what? And then that's when they short circuit. That's what's actually going on in the schools. And sometimes they will say acting white, right? But what do they really mean? They want to know why folk like myself, right? Why are we assimilating? Why are we giving up our blackness in exchange for what? Why are we doing, right? And they may not have the language in fourth or fifth or sixth or seventh grade. But that's actually what they're asked. What they're not saying is learning is bad. They don't actually mean that. They want to know, why are you changing your voice? Why are you dressing like that? Why do you act like that when she walks in the room? And or they use oversimplified language. Why are you acting white? That's what's actually going on.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your thought-provoking questions. And thank you for being here tonight to hear these amazing authors speak. So I just want to thank Dr. Payne, Mr. Chambers, and Dr. Hitchens for being here, for doing this work and really exemplifying, you know, how do we expand the expert. And so with that, we will close out.
Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you all so much.